Thank you. Please be seated. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in the interest of JFC and other minor children. Due process protections are as if your appointed lawyer can read the rules, your constitutional rights can be preserved.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I'm trying to understand what the due process, how due process is protected by a rule that your appointed lawyer doesn't follow.
But your appointed lawyer, under ineffective assistance of counsel, not.
Well, you said due process is fully preserved, and I'm just trying to understand.
Due process fundamentally preservation of error rule should be the rule that requires a parent to object to the jury charge before they complain about it on appeal. And in determining what process is due, the United States Supreme Court has applied a three-factor test, which was first established in Matthews versus Eldridge, and later adopted in a termination case, Blaster versus Department of Public Services. And in that case, in Lassiter, the Supreme Court considered whether an indigent parent was required to be appointed counsel, whether due process required this. And the Supreme Court said no, that due process did not require that the Constitution did not require that appointed counsel be the extended to parent termination. So in evaluating the three factors, these factors first are that the court must recognize the private interest at stake. And then the court must evaluate the countervailing governmental interest. And third, the court must weigh in the risk of error that is associated with the state's chosen procedure.
Well, and that would you focus a minute on that third requirement from Lassiter, the risk that the procedure will lead to an erroneous decision? If we are dealing with a question of waiver, as we are here, then don't we have a substantial risk that the procedure could lead to an erroneous decision? In fact, when we don't have, for example, in this case, a determination by the jury on the appropriate legal grounds determination?
No, Your Honor. The risk of error is minimal. And the reason the risk of error is minimal is because the Texas procedural rules provide parents an adequate procedure for preventing that error.
Well, it depends on whether or not their counsel does his or her job.
Yes, Your Honor, but due process only requires that the trial be fundamentally fair. And in determining that it's fundamentally fair, the issue is not, the constitutional inquiry is not whether juries might be confused by an erroneous jury instruction.
Well, I'm not as concerned about the confusion at this point about the total absence of an instruction that the Texas legislature has determined is part of the law for deciding to terminate parental rights.
I would clarify, Your Honor, that there's not a total absence of best interest instruction because...
As to one parent, there was.
This court has specifically accepted the pattern jury's charge instruction, and that instruction only requires a disjunctive question
I don't disagree about that, but I believe it was asked to the mother. Even with the disjunctive question that was submitted, there was no mention of best interest in the instruction to the jury.
I agree that the jury charge could be misleading as to the other.
Well, I mean, there was a total absence of one of the requirements in the family code for grounds for termination.
Well, if we look at the jury charge, and actually the record supports this, because the jury charge was read in open court. If, for example, there had been a paragraph return and that best interest instruction would have been separated, then it could have been said that the best interest instruction pertained to both the mother and the father.
What I'm concerned about is that third element in Lassiter, the risk that the procedure will lead to an erroneous decision. And if we have a case in which the lawyer did not object and the state, for some reason, did not submit the appropriate issue to the jury that included both a ground for termination and the best interest requirement in the instruction, we have a total absence of that going to the jury. The state didn't submit it. The judge didn't catch it, apparently, and the lawyer for the parents did not object to the failure to submit it. Why isn't there a substantial risk that we could have erroneous decisions because we're allowing a waiver ground to control the ultimate decision in a parental termination case?
Because, Your Honor, under the due process clause analysis, that risk of error has to be has to be considered in the protections that the due process clause afford. That is notice and an opportunity to be heard. Texas Rule of Civil Procedure 272 provides that notice. This is not an issue of whether parents never see the jury charge until after judgment has been rendered. This is not an issue of that the parents don't get an opportunity to complain about an error in the jury charge. They get an opportunity to complain about an error in the jury charge. For that reason, the risk of error is minimal. Yes, it may have happened in this case, but that does not mean that it will happen in every termination case. And constitutional due process protections don't weigh in favor of ignoring the state's procedural rules when they provide a fundamentally fair trial.
Was this appointed counsel in the trial court?
Was
this appointed counsel in trial court?
Yes, Your Honor.
In a criminal case, the U.S. Supreme Court, I guess, requires Anders briefs to be filed. They require issues to be raised on behalf of a convicted defendant, even if the lawyer doesn't think there are grounds for bringing the appeal.
That's correct.
There. And the U.S. Supreme Court requires, I guess, criminal courts to review underlying cases for ineffective assistance of counsel. And so I suppose these get imposed because of the criminal defendant's entitled to a lawyer, the state's required to appoint them a lawyer, and we give the defendants the additional protection that they can even get their case reversed if their lawyer doesn't do the things the lawyer's supposed to do. Should we distinguish between those cases where parents in a termination have court-appointed counsel and consider the states then having a further obligation to assure that any errors are appropriately reviewed on appeal, as opposed to cases where people are not entitled to appointed counsel, and therefore the state does not have an interest in assuring that the lawyer that is representing them presents all the appropriate issues on appeal?
No, Your Honor. This court should not distinguish between cases in which termination proceedings in which there is an appointed lawyer versus where there is no appointed lawyer, because the criminal standard for ineffective assistance of counsel derives from the Sixth Amendment's right to counsel guarantee. And that amendment clearly applies by quite plain language to criminal cases. In any instance, if the court looks to guidance from criminal law, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals recently said in Ex parte Graves that the statutory right to competent counsel did not equal a right to effective assistance of counsel. So, in comparison, because there is a right to appointed counsel in termination cases, that does not necessarily include a right to effective assistance of counsel. Moreover, ineffective assistance of counsel claims in criminal cases are brought on collateral review. The has issues, I mean, the evidence or facts pertaining to that issue would be matters outside the record. In a civil case, in civil trial system or procedure set up that we have, we don't have any type of collateral review for civil cases. So it would be troublesome to see how issues of ineffective assistance of counsel could be raised in direct appeal.
I have another question, though, that makes this situation unique. One of the grounds for termination in the family code can be that the parent's rights to another child have been earlier terminated in a later proceeding. So if we have a circumstance such as this where there's been a waiver of the failure to submit appropriate instructions to the jury and judgment is entered terminating the parental rights, then after that, in subsequent proceedings, that first judgment seems to me to infect everything that happens afterwards. How does that then fit into this analysis? That seems to make that waiver have an effect that goes far beyond just even the instant proceeding.
It could, Your Honor. But the court should not develop a broad rule that could apply to all termination cases based on what happened in this case. Because that ground in the Texas Family Code, Section 161.001M, only allows for termination in subsequent proceedings if the parent had a termination based on grounds D or E. Only two narrow grounds. So in this case, the predicate grounds alleged for termination was ground D as to the mother and ground O, and then ground E as to the father and ground O. So because this court allows for disjunctive questions, we can't really know whether the jury actually terminated on predicate ground O or predicate ground D.
And so you're saying that then...
But necessarily, the judgment reflects that, and that can be used. But there's also a whole other laundry list of factors that could be used to terminate parental rights. And if there was an error in the jury charge, for example, if it had been different grounds, then...
But my concern then, it seems to me, that we have a little bit broader question that we have to answer here. Because if the waiver in the initial proceeding results in termination on one of the statutory grounds that can be the predicate for future termination actions, then in fact this waiver has far greater significance than just in the current proceeding that is at issue.
Again, Your Honor,
and how does due process accommodate that?
Again, it would go back to whether there was fair notice and opportunity to object. That is fundamental fairness. That is what the procedural due process clause protects. It protects fundamental fairness. And the reason that the preservation of error rules are fundamentally fair is because the parents have the opportunity to object. The parents looked at this jury charge. They actually said that they had one objection. They objected to the instruction on clear and convincing evidence. If the error is so glaring to this court, then it should have been revealed. I mean, at least the parents had fair notice and opportunity to minimize the error.
In all fairness as well, the state regularly engages in termination proceedings, and these were the state's issues, and the state did have an obligation to present correctly and completely to the judge for consideration before submitting to the jury. So,
yes, Your Honor,
the state did not do that.
Yes, the state should be held to its duty to present a fair and correct charge.
I want to make sure I understood your answer to one of the prior questions. Are you saying that this termination order cannot be the basis for subsequent terminations, or it can?
Yes, this one can, because it did include the grounds D and E, which are the only grounds that will support a subsequent termination.
So automatically, in this case, this couple can no longer have children.
Not necessarily, Your Honor. I mean, the state can allege that along with other predicate grounds, but it's actually the jury's determination as to whether they were terminated.
Well, my question is, can this charge be collaterally attacked in those proceedings? I mean, for example, in a future termination proceeding, if the parents come in and try to say, well, you know, this was a defective charge, we were held to have waived it in this first case, but it was defective, can they collaterally attack a subsequent termination proceeding or collaterally attack this judgment in a subsequent case to retain the right to their children?
I don't believe that there is an avenue for collaterally attacking.
So this is it.
Unless
the state's position is this. This is it. This waiver results in them never having children again.
No, Your Honor, that is not true, because that is only one of the predicate acts that the state can allege for termination. There is a whole laundry list. There's like 26 predicate acts that the state can use to ask a jury to terminate parental rights. It's not necessarily conclusive or automatically assumed that this ground for termination would be alleged to terminate future children.
I understand that a future child was terminated. What grounds did the state use for that termination?
In the two subsequent children in Bastrop?
Well, yes.
Actually what happened, Your Honor, there would be three children that were removed in Waco. Parents moved to Austin, and a child was born here in Austin.
That's my understanding.
And that child was removed at birth.
And on what grounds did the state rely to remove that child? And my understanding is that resulted in a termination, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And what grounds did the state rely upon for that termination proceeding?
I don't know all of the grounds. I do know that one of the grounds was on endangerment.
So it was based then on this judgment?
Not on this judgment. Nothing has been based on this judgment.
It was endangerment as to that child?
Endangerment as to that child.
Now, my understanding was that they took the child right after birth.
Yes, Your Honor.
How could there have been a separate endangerment finding that didn't relate back to this judgment?
Well, because there was evidence of there was reason to believe that the child would be endangered by the parents' drug use, the parents' violence.
Which was all based on this judgment?
Yes.
So,
not based on this judgment, Your Honor. This is based on, when you bring an initial proceeding, it's based on the Department's investigation of the facts as they exist to those parents. It's not based on prior judgment. It is a factual, it's an investigative inquiry. So the department was investigating and had reason to believe that this child would be endangered by being left with his parents. That's why they took it into custody, and then they moved and presented evidence, all new evidence, not this prior judgment.
They didn't introduce the prior judgment?
No, they did not introduce
it. Had nothing to do with that subsequent termination?
I'm sorry, no, ma'am. This judgment has not been used in any subsequent termination at all.
But then they used the Austin judgment on the two Bastrop terminations.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Although I thought you just said they didn't.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I thought you said they didn't use this judgment in the Bastrop termination.
I'm talking about the Waco judgment, the one that the court is reviewing here.
Right.
No, the Waco judgment has not been used. The Austin judgment on the baby that was born here in Austin, that one was used to support a subsequent termination in Bastrop County.
Okay, but this one has not been used in subsequent termination.
Absolutely not.
One quick question. On the first two Lassiter grounds, tell me why the countervailing public interest in preservation of error trumps the private interest in parents' rights to raise their children.
In this case, Your Honor, because the Texas Family Code especially established that the state's public interest is in protecting the safety and welfare of children. And that is exactly the interest that the United States Supreme Court has recognized is the state interest.
We're supposed to look at the whole interest of the Family Code proceedings under it, and not just the interest in not waiving error under Lassiter. The interest that we look at in number two, the countervailing public interest, is in your opinion, is for the whole proceeding and the whole result, and not just our interest in Rule 272. Being enshrined.
Yes, well, Your Honor, what the governmental interest would be, of course, is that protecting the safety and the welfare of the children, but also, as to Rule 272, in protecting the efficiency of the judicial process, in standardizing proceedings for litigants, in ensuring fairness in all trials. That would be particular state interest as to Rule 272 in the due process analysis. But I think the court needs to also consider the public policy that the state is charged with, and that is establishing permanency in these children's lives who have already been tragically abused and neglected.
You acknowledged a moment ago that the state has an obligation to the court to submit a proper charge on in parental termination cases.
Yes,
why
Your
wasn't
Honor.
That done here?
I don't know, Your Honor. It was an oversight.
I mean, it seems to me in private practice, one reason for that is a tactical advantage. If you think that the opposing counsel won't notice a deficiency in the charge that is advantageous to your client in that case, then you might propose a charge that way and leave it up to the court to find the error. Do you think that might have happened here?
I don't believe that we can assume a negative or malicious motive on the part of the state. I don't know why the error went unnoticed. I don't know how the error happened. A reasonable possibility could be that the state did present a charge, but that the court, retyped the charge. And in retyping it, that the error occurred. I think that's a reasonable possibility.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
If please the court, Mr. Melvin Brass, will give an argument to this comment.
Good morning. If please the court. The question before the court is the difference between substantive and procedural due process. The question before the court is the Supreme Court of the United States decision in MLB versus SLJ, which says that as a matter of substantive due process, there must be a specific finding of conduct that will support determination. This court, when it decided EB, did not address that question. And before what you have here is a disjunctive submission at best, a defective in that it doesn't even address the question of best interest, and it's to
are you making a substantive due process argument as opposed to a procedural due process
yes,
argument? There seems to be a lot of confusion in the briefing about
yes, ma'am. It is a substantive.
So you are not claiming that there is a procedural due process problem.
No, it's a substantive due process. And the problem is this, and I apologize for not having this court's opinions on the word or, but there's a case out of Amarillo called In the Interest of SH. It's at 548 Southwest 2nd 804. And it holds that a question that is submitted or a finding that a person did A or B is not a finding that they did either. It does not mean that they did A. It does not mean that they did B. So what you then have...
What does it mean?
It means nothing. Because it's not a specific finding. And under MLB versus SLJ, which is cited in
we submit charges all the time where we say, did the defendant drive negligently with respect to brakes or with respect to lookout? And they say yes, and we don't have anything?
Under this situation, and I believe that if it was raised in that, it's not a finding.
So our whole general charge philosophy in the last 20 years has been illegitimate.
It's been flawed. The answer is very simple, Your Honor. All you have to do is ask the jury, answer yes or no to the following. Did Paige Cox place the children in a situation that endangered them? Did he place them with children, with people who endangered them? Did he place them in a situation
that endangered them? I mean, that's not a broad, that is not a broad form submission then.
But,
I think
but then you get the specific answer that the Supreme Court
well, I understand,
has said.
But to follow up on what Chief Justice Phillips just asked then, and that means that we have had a problem for the last 20 years with broad form submission.
Yes, and this court addressed it in Crown versus Castillo Light. Because you don't know who was grabbing on what when you have a broad form submission. And because we're dealing with parental rights, we have an elevated standard we have to deal with. What we have in the question that was submitted to the jury is to be engaged in conduct which endangers the physical well-being of the child. Did he engage in conduct which endangered the emotional well-being of the child? Did he knowingly place the child with persons who engaged in conduct which endangered the physical well-being of the child? Did he knowingly place the child with persons who engaged in conduct which endangered the emotional well-being of the child? Or did he fail to comply with provisions of the court order that established and so forth? You have six different grounds, and you have no way of knowing if 10 jurors agreed on any single
ground. All right, let me ask, is this the sole underpinning of your substantive due process argument?
No.
Okay, would you move to the other? I'd be curious to hear.
The question is, where is the specific finding of conduct?
Well, I thought that's what you were just arguing.
Well, that is, and that goes to the very crux of the question presented by His Honor, the Chief Justice. The oral submission is fatally flawed.
No, but you have just recited what would be a granulated submission, which was a form of jury charge submission that Texas abandoned some 20 years ago.
Yes.
The question that was asked of this jury is whether or not the parent's rights to the child should be terminated.
Okay.
That was the jury question. The rest were in the form of instructions.
That's right. And I think that is procedurally and substantively flawed because you don't know what they're specifically answering. All they're answering the question is should it be terminated, and that's a general finding of neglect.
Well, I guess my question is it critical to your winning your substantive due process argument that we find the charge was flawed in that respect? Or do you have a separate due process argument?
You have to find that the charge was flawed in that respect because that goes to the very question that the court was addressing on the petitioner's argument of the waiver question. Can this be waived? These are the questions of substantive due process. This question of how it was submitted to the jury, how they answered, whether there was an objection or not. These are all tied together.
Well, if instructions were proper as opposed to a number of individual questions, if instructions are proper under our broad form submission, would the failure to include the best interest instruction specifically as to the mother support your substantive due process argument?
Yes.
So it does not then hinge just on the disjunctive affirmative question.
Well, okay, I'm tying the two together because you're missing one part as to the mother. And it's part of the instruction that the jury is relying on answering the questions whether the patient or maybe this term. And I don't know how to parse them out because as the court reveals and as Waco noted, how do you reverse this mother and return the children to her and have father there?
Well, explain your argument, your substantive due process argument as it relates to the failure to instruct on best interest as to mom.
Okay. As to mom, there's two parts. First off, as to best interest, the jury would not instruct her that they had to find that it was in the best interest of the children to have a parental rights terminated.
Well, your client had a right to have that submitted. Why doesn't that become a procedural due process question in terms of whether or not they can now complain about that?
Well, because you go to MLB versus SLJ, when the Supreme Court of the United States says that the general finding of neglect, which is should rights be terminated, and that's all it is.
Yes, but it seems that before you can reach that particular question, you have to cross the procedural due process hurdle, which is whether or not you've had an opportunity to present that to the jury and you chose not to.
The problem with...
I'm just having a hard time putting the pieces together on that.
The problem with Your Honor's logic is this. And you have to work backwards. When you look at MLB versus SLJ, they looked at what is the judgment, and is there a specific finding in the judgment that will support termination? Forget how it was argued, forget whether there's a waiver. And this judgment doesn't support it.
Well, but
because there's not a specific finding.
Well, but under our broad form submission, there is a finding that the parental rights should be terminated, and that can support a judgment under Texas law.
And it is fatally failed under MLB versus SLJ because there has to be a specific finding of conduct.
As Justice O'Neill said, leave behind that particular argument and go to the failure to submit on the best interest.
Okay. Under Crown versus Castillo, this court's decision, on a much less important issue than the termination of parental rights, this court reversed because of the possibility that the jury could have found on different grounds. Here...
And one of them did not support a judgment.
Right. And in this case, we have no evidence of violation of the court order. This court is going to have to find that the Pangolin Service Plan is a court order. There is no evidence of a court order that specifically set forth the grounds of what they have to do to obtain the return of their children. And a Pangolin Service Plan doesn't rise to that level. That's a CPS caseworker. So we're missing that element entirely.
I need to go back to the construct of analyzing this because I'm very, very confused. Okay. Our starting point has to be whether or not you can even complain about the charge at this point.
Yes.
So what is the nature of that, of your legal argument that says we should be allowed to look at your complaints about the charge?
Okay. As a matter of substantive due process, the procedure that the court used comply with due process under the 14th Amendment. And contrary to what counsel says, and to address the question of the right to effective counsel, this is a quasi-criminal proceeding. It's technically civil. The right to counsel in the civil case springs from the Fifth Amendment, not the Sixth.
But again, that gets you to the substance of your objection.
Right.
So we have to get over the procedural hurdle that that objection was never presented to the trial court, as Texas civil procedure requires. What is it that gets you over that to where we can even answer that question?
Well, the answer to that is the 14th Amendment due process.
Oh, but we have plenty of authority out of this court that indicates that if constitutional arguments are not raised in the trial court, we will not consider them for the first time on appeal. So I'm still trying to get, I mean, understand that you have objections to the charge. Mm-hmm. You think it shouldn't have been a broad form submission, it shouldn't have been disjunctive, best interest should have been submitted. None of those things were brought to the attention of the trial court.
Okay.
So Texas civil procedure required you to do that in order for an appellate court to review the charge.
Okay.
How do we get past that hurdle that in the trial court the parents did not comport with what Texas civil procedure requires?
And then I throw back on the court. Where is the specific finding required by MLB versus SLJ of conduct that would warrant termination?
Was error preserved in MLB versus SLJ?
My recollection is it was addressed solely on the basis of what the judgment decided.
But error was preserved below.
My understanding in reading the appellate record and predecessor cases, it did not have to do with the charge, it had to do specifically with what was in the judgment. And the fact that the judgment did not comport with the process.
But was an objection made in the trial court to the form of the judgment?
It was made on appeal. I'm unaware that it was made in the trial court.
For the first time on appeal?
Pardon?
For the first time on appeal?
That's all that I'm aware of.
Okay. Mr. Bradley, I mean, this court has gotten away a long time ago from fundamental error, which was the notion that some error occurred in the trial court that was so fundamental to the issue of justice that the appellate courts would allow the question to be raised on appeal. And although everybody's tried to avoid using that word, either in the Court of Appeals or in the briefs, really your argument is that this is fundamental error. Your point is the U.S. Supreme Court says you can't terminate, judgment or otherwise, unless there's a specific finding in the trial court of a grounds for termination. You say this judgment doesn't have a specific finding of termination, therefore it's an unconstitutional judgment. And that objection ought to be allowed to be raised on appeal for the first time because it's fundamental. That's really your issue. And this court long ago said if it's the type of thing that can be presented to the trial court before it comes up, we're just not going to entertain it on appeal because the trial court ought to have an opportunity to fix that. Do you have any U.S. Supreme Court authority that says that an appellate court must accept fundamental error if the objection is to the judgment not being supported by a ground determination?
No, Your Honor, I do not have a specific case that I can point to that says that. However, I have to address the question that was raised on the petitioner's case. The child following this was taken from the hospital the day after the child was born.
Do you agree that that was not based, though, on this judgment?
I disagree. That was the initial basis. Now, they went in and said that he didn't follow an order. And the judgment as such is technically correct.
that it does not rely upon a termination in this case, but the reason for grabbing the child when it's 24 hours old is this judgment.
If we remand this case, can they rely on Austin and Bastrom to take these children home?
They can rely upon Austin because that judgment is technically correct. It makes specific findings that they did this and they did that. As far as Bastrop, I respectfully argue that no, they cannot, because that's a disjunctive submission. And it's a disjunctive judgment. They did A or B or C or D, and there's nothing there.
Let me ask you, would your argument allow parents to lie behind the law, not object to a charge, realizing that if they kept the case in the appellate system long enough, it would prevent adoption? I mean, the state is asserting the child's interest here in finality and being able to move on with their life. And couldn't this ability to bring appeals on all these different bases result in parents preventing their children from being adopted?
Your Honor, it's only for a brief period. And again, I realize while this case has been pending for 3 years, there was some mutual certainty. On the appellate level, Your Honor.
Only judgment, 3 years in the appellate.
Judgment was in March of 99. These cases now require expedited consideration. In this court, I believe, has a policy if you get one extension of time on filing a petition before review. That's what happened in the Cox case. I hope. I requested an extension of time, and so I get one that was it. And we filed that. So the legislature has recognized that, and these are on a fast track. When the rights are so important, when they're protected under the First and the Ninth and the 14th Amendments, can we say that they're not entitled to proper counsel, whether appointed or not? Now, there are some issues that you cannot look at and determine from the record. This comes up across the hall all the time. Can you determine from this record that the counsel was ineffective? And usually the answer is no. But when you make no objection to something that is so fundamental, how can you say that they got the due process in the counsel that they're entitled to?
But I guess the answer to my question then is only if the court decides to expedite and in fact expedites and it all goes through real quickly, then that concern would not be raised.
But Your Honor, we're going back to the standard procedure of TDPRS. TDPRS, in every case that I've been involved in that has had a termination issue, has asked for expedited consideration.
But that doesn't mean that always happens.
I understand. Certain circumstances can be controlled. But there is a limit.
But there is, you'd acknowledge there's a risk.
But I think it's a nominal risk out of the interest of the state. If this was an ordinary civil case, if it was something other than the civil equivalent of death benefit, there wouldn't be a substantive due process issue. It's because we're dealing with such fundamental rights as recognized by standard versus federal.
Did the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure relating to jury charge and objections to the charge, did they provide notice and a meaningful opportunity to be heard?
Technically, yes. But it has to be exercised. This is the case.
All I'm asking is on the face of the rules. Is there a procedure in place that gives notice and a meaningful opportunity to be heard?
Yes, ma'am. And on the face, the statutory framework for termination is constitutionally correct. The problem is the way it's implemented.
As I understand the record, the jury was instructed or told by lawyers and by the judge a minimum of 35 times. Of the requirements that the jury makes determination in the best interest of the children. Why isn't the error that you're claiming here harmless error, since really the jury knew what was going on?
The problem is they presume to follow the charge that they're given. They're not presumed to follow argument because sometimes there's an incorrect argument, and I believe we've had the case on that point in my brief. The charge here is totally missing that you have to find in the best interest of the children to terminate that children.
As a practical matter, what happens if rights are not terminated as to mom, but are terminated as to dad?
As a practical...
And they're still together. And how does that work?
That is an unusual circumstance, Your Honor. I'm unaware of any circumstance where that situation has existed. I'm aware of cases where TDPRS has come in and insisted that there be a board so that they would bring termination proceedings against the parent whose rights have not been terminated because they're now exposing them to somebody whose rights have.
Well, I guess my question is, does the child then stay in foster care and just get to have contact with mom?
Well,
or does the child go back to the home?
I don't see why she would be entitled to have them back because her rights haven't been terminated. And we have changed, the legislature has changed the termination statutes by putting in deadlines to prevent this in limbo forever under temporary orders, which that essentially is if they're taking foster care forever. There either has to be a termination or a return. And I'm drawing a blank on the specific provision. I want to say it's like 161.2, 161.2. It's where there has to be a final order within 12 months, and if not, the court can extend it for 6 months, and that's it. You either have to terminate it, or she doesn't have to return.
But you just don't know the answer.
I don't know the answer. But you would be in the grass at best.
So unlikely the jury would find not the best interest to return to dad, but find it is in best interest to return to mom. I mean, that would be kind of odd.
But we're back to, if we're looking at this charge, what was the answer based on? We don't know, because it's the disjunctive submission. But as the law presently stands, as I understand it, if this is fatally flawed as to mom, she's entitled to return to the children, even if the rights are terminated as that, and there might or might not have to be some further proceeding. Because there's nothing to stop him from coming in and seeking to adopt the children. At that point, if he can prove he's an outfit now.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
First, there is no substantive due process challenge in this case. The Waco Court of Appeals held that Texas procedural waiver rules would violate procedural due process. There was no substantive due process either raised nor addressed by the Waco Court of Appeals. Moreover, the parents confused the issue of substantive due process with procedural due process. A substantive due process challenge would lie against a statute that directly affected the parents' right to control the upbringing of their children. And this is recognized by the United States Supreme Court in Troxville versus Granville, where the Supreme Court reviewed a statute that allowed any person, including a grandparent, to petition for a visitation right. And the court held that that would violate the parent's substantive due process right to directly control the upbringing of their children. Now, while the Cox's challenge may indirectly affect a fundamental right to control the upbringing of your children because the termination judgment severed the parent-child relationship, that subordinate effect is not enough to ride the procedural due process challenge that is raised here against the preservation for error rules to a substantive due process. So therefore, the court should not pause, spend too much time on that. Second, I would like to correct what I believe is a misunderstanding the Supreme Court's decision in MLB versus FLJ, which is reported at 519 U.S. 102, and it was decided in 1996. This case concerned whether due process would prohibit a state from denying a parent's access to their right to appeal for their inability to pay for a child transfer. And in evaluating the parent's constitutional right under the due process analysis set forth in Matthews versus Eldridge, the court determined that although in termination cases, they were not your regular run-of-the-mill civil cases because they had constitutional protection, that it would violate due process to deny parents the right to equal access to court. And therefore, the case did not concern anything about a jury charge, and whether it was preserved or not is not the issue in that case. Finally, I want to go ahead and readdress the concern expressed by Justice O'Neill and Justice Hankinson
that this erroneous judgment, the finding waiver of this erroneous judgment, might somehow preclude the parents' right to ever have children. Again, I believe that that risk is minimal. Certainly, although there is not a established collateral proceeding to challenge a civil judgment, certainly in that subsequent proceeding, when the state seeks to terminate the parental rights based on ground M and based on the other finding the jury must make, that it is in the best interest of the children, certainly the parents can challenge use of that judgment because they can raise that it was an erroneous judgment and that it's not in the best interest of the children to terminate parental rights based on an erroneous judgment. So the parents will have an opportunity to challenge this again, and you know, they missed the first bite of the apple. The court should not give them a second bite of the apple because that is more than what the constitutional due process fundamental fairness requires in these cases.
If we agree with you in this case and reverse the judgment of the Waco Court of Appeals, do we need to return the case to the Waco Court for consideration of other issues raised by the parents on appeal?
This judgment might somehow preclude the parents' right to ever have children. Again, I believe that that risk is minimal. Certainly, although there is not a established collateral proceeding to challenge a civil judgment, certainly in that subsequent proceeding when the state seeks to terminate the parental rights based on ground M and based on the other finding the jury must make that it is in the best interest of the children, certainly the parents can challenge use of that judgment because they can raise that it was an erroneous judgment and that it's not in the best interest of the children to terminate parental rights based on an erroneous judgment. So the parents will have an opportunity to challenge this again, and you know, they missed the first bite of the apple. The court should not give them a second bite of the apple because that is more than what the constitutional due process fundamental fairness requires in these cases.
If we agree with you in this case and reverse the judgment of the Waco Court of Appeals, do we need to return the case to the Waco Court for consideration of other issues raised by the parents on appeal?
We believe that the court can decide those issues, and that would avoid unnecessary.
They've not all been briefed here. As I understand from the Waco decision, there were multiple issues there, but not all of those have been raised here. That's what I'm trying to understand. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor, you are correct. There were 11 issues raised, and most of those issues have been rebriefed in this court. But I believe that the issues regarding the challenge to ground O, which was the court order regarding contempt criminal proceedings, I believe that issues have not been fully briefed in this court. We would be happy to submit post-submission briefing on those issues that have not been addressed and have the court reversed and rendered the court appeals.
Was there evidence to support termination under all of the grounds submitted in the charge?
Yes, Your Honor.
The court order ground, there was evidence to support that?
Yes, Your Honor.
What was that?
Well, the parents actually fully admitted in their own testimony that they voluntarily chose to ignore obeying the court order.
And what is the status of the children? Are they still in foster care? Do you know?
My understanding from the caseworker, Your Honor, is that the children were initially in a home where the foster parents were considering adopting the three children so that they could stay together. And since that time, since this case has been pending, those plans have fallen through. And the children are in different homes. And yes, there are in homes that the parents are considering adopting them. And those parents realize, the foster parents realize, that they're taking a risk because this judgment is not final yet. And until this court decides this case, the children's permanency is in limbo.
The court order that you say there's evidence that they violated admitted, was that CPS directives, or was there something else when you say that there
was? It was temporary orders entered by the trial court.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the second call.